Okay, so we're going to start the Haggadah, but before we begin speaking about the text of the Haggadah, there is a question on the entirety of the Haggadah, which is, whose name is conspicuously missing from the Haggadah? Most important figure whose name is completely absent from the Haggadah, anyone? Who is the most important character in the story of the Exodus? Moshe. His name does not exist in the entire Haggadah. It's just an interesting observation. Any thoughts on why not? Why is Moses, the hero of the story, not to be found in the entire book? Not even the Chad Gadya or later editions. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so he could have gotten an honorable mention, but so in order to emphasize the aspect of the miraculous exodus and the miracles that took place, Moses is sort of obliterated from the Haggadah, and the idea is to remember to focus on the main thing, which is God taking the Jews out of Egypt, and so Moses is out. The Haggadah begins, interestingly, many Haggadahs begin with the Kol Chamira text, which is in Aramaic, and states that any chametz that you have, you declare null and void, and that it's not yours. Here it's on page 1. And that's because the idea of destroying or burning your chametz is actually rabbinic. From the Torah, it's sufficient to nullify and disown your chametz. And if you do that, you fulfilled your mitzvah. So if you disowned your chametz, even if there's a pile of bread sitting somewhere and it belongs to you, but you completely dissociated and made it available to anyone who wants to take it, you fulfilled your mitzvah, and that's the Kol Chamira. The reason it's written in Aramaic is because Aramaic was the common language among Jews at this time, which is why many Jews make sure to say the Kol Chamira actually in English. The point is, it should be something that you understand and that you're aware. It's a sort of a legal statement. What you're doing is removing your ownership from whatever chametz you may have. So it may actually be better to say it in English. You know, people like saying it Aramaic, but it's actually important to say it in English and to understand what's being said. The next thing that a lot of people do. Anyone here sing the Kadesh Orchatz? Kadesh Orchatz, yeah. So the reason for that, the reason the Seder, unlike any other Jewish ceremony, we have that order, it's sort of a oral table of content. The reason for that is because back in the day, not everyone had written books. And so the Seder was a long and complex ritual, and so they instituted this oral table of content that allows you to remember the entire Seder and what you're supposed to do. And so that's the way to remember it. Some people attribute it to Rashi, others to the Balei HaTosfot, but the bottom line is it goes back about 800-900 years. So the reason is to just make sure that everyone had the order in mind. It was a good way to remember things. This year, when making Kaddish, there's three mitzvahs you'll be fulfilling. One is the mitzvah of Kiddush on Yom Tov, right? So every Pesach you go, you make Kiddush, that's one mitzvah. The other thing you'll be doing is this year, when's the first night of the Seder? Shabbat, Friday night. So when you do Kaddish, yeah, so you're doing a mitzvah from the Torah of making Kiddush. And so you're also fulfilling the mitzvah of Kiddush from the Torah. Third, and this people are not so aware of, is when you do Kaddish, you're fulfilling the mitzvah of the first cup. Kiddush is the first of the four cups. And so I believe from what I've seen, and I've been to quite a lot of seders, from what I've seen, I think I've seen it everywhere I've been, is that when people do Kiddush Seder night, everyone says it, and obviously everyone drinks a full cup. You can't do like Friday night where you get a bit. You don't even need to have someone pour. Some people like pour on Friday night from the person making Kiddush. You don't need that. on Pesach night, it's best that every single person have their own, it's required that every person have their own cup, but it's also best that every person verbalize the Kiddush on their own and not rely on the host. So that's it as far as Kaddish is concerned, and you drink it leaning to the left to signify freedom and comfort. Next is Orchatz. Orchatz is very interesting because Orchatz, we wash our hands without a bracha. And why is it that we wash our hands without a bracha? That's a good one. Why do you wash your hands without a bracha for Orchatz before you eat the wet vegetable? So it's interesting, in the laws in the times of the Mishnah, people were very careful about the laws of purity, and they would wash their hands before eating any wet fruit or vegetable. Now, there are those who still do it to this day, but it's very rare to find people who will go and wash their hands before eating wet fruit or vegetable, say, around the Hanukkah time. Some people will be like very strict and do it, but most of us don't do it. So why is it that on Passover night we do this thing of washing our hands before eating a wet fruit or vegetable? Is it, we're just on best behavior? What is it? Why are we washing our hands on this night? So some explain, the Netziv Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin explains that the reason is because these laws of purity were kept with tremendous caution in the times of the temple, when people were really careful about the laws of purity and impurity. And so, on this night where we remember the Passover sacrifice, when we're sort of reenacting what Jews did in the time of the temple or the tabernacle, we behave the way they did. So on this night where we're sort of eating things that represent the Korban Pesach, we're observing the laws of purity the way they were observed in the time of the temple. So that's the idea for Orchatz. So even though year-round we may not wash our hands before eating a wet fruit or vegetable, tonight we're doing it because that's the way it was done in the time there were sacrifices and there was a temple. And so to sort of keep that spirit alive, we wash our hands before eating a wet fruit or vegetable. So that's for Orchatz. Fair enough? All right. So the prayer for washing is only for bread. That's only for bread. So washing is only for bread and in the morning. When people wake up, they wash their hand, they make a bracha, that's it. The washing for fruit and vegetables because it wasn't instituted as strictly, there's no blessing instituted for it as well. Oh, the eating of the karpas. Good point. Excellent. Yes. So that's, I guess, karpas? No, you're right. So we'll move on to karpas. So karpas is you take a vegetable. There's different customs. Some people do celery. Some people do a potato. Anyone else? What other? Parsley? I never tried it. Is it good? Yeah. Okay, so some people do parsley, potato, celery. Deveined celery. I didn't hear that one yet. Okay, so you dip the celery into, or whatever it is, parsley or whatever it is that you're eating, and you put it in the salt water and you make a borei pri ha'adama. Now you're asking, why don't we say anything like we say for maror or anything else? So that really comes back to the question of why is it that we dip the vegetable in the salt water? Most of us assume that I guess in American Jewry, or I guess among most Jews, there's this accepted assumption, which is that we dip it in the salt water for what reason? To remember the tears of the Jews. So that's one of the explanations. It's actually not a unanimous matter. It's not a matter of consensus. And it actually makes a big difference what the reason is. I'll tell you in a second. Some people say it's just we do something different. in order for the kids to ask and to sort of bring up the topic to show that this night is different, like we say in the Manishtana, Shebechol Halelot and Halayla Azeh Shtei Pe'amim. That's one reason. But another reason people give is that it's actually a royal way of behaving. Remember, if you were a pauper, if you were anyone living, let's say, 200 years ago, you had a main course, and that's about it. There was no dessert, there was no first course. And so the idea is that on this night, we sort of have a vorspeise. It's a way of showing, liberty, and a way of showing that you're living it big. So some say that's the reason for eating karpas. Now, what does it matter what the explanation is? There actually is a big difference. The difference is, do you eat the karpas reclining or not? Because if the reason for the dipping is to remember the sorrow of the Jews, then just like with Maror, it would make sense not to recline. When we remember things that remind us of our suffering, we don't recline. Recline is a way of showing being leisurely people, being people that are now living in a royal way. So if the explanation for the dipping of the karpas is to remember the tears, then you should not recline. However, if the explanation for the karpas is to behave in a royal way or to show that there's something special about this night, you can recline. So depending on what attitude you'll take here, that's what you'll do in terms of reclining. So it's interesting that, you know, there's a big difference in terms of what the accepted explanation is for the karpas. All right, then comes yachatz. Yachatz, breaking of the middle matzah, and the large part is saved for the afikoman for later. It's put in a, anyone ever see those, cases that they, does anyone have a special case for the afikoman? Oh, we just put it in like a napkin or something. What? You see, yeah, so they have these cases for afikoman, but the bottom line is, the putting, the whole thing also with people stealing the afikoman and looking for it, that all comes from the fact that you are supposed to, you can't just leave the afikoman out. It has to be bundled up. And so the question is, there's a few questions at this point. First of all, why do you split the matzah? Why the middle matzah? And why do you hide the afikoman? Hiding the afikoman is not just to, you know, get a prize later. It's because you're not supposed to have the afikoman out in the open. There's a few reasons for this. So first of all, the reason for breaking it is because the matzah is referred to as a lechem oni, a bread of affliction, of poverty. And my wife and I were once on a flight from Israel to the States, and we were supposed to stop off in Switzerland and then fly to New York. But the flight left late from Ben Gurion Airport, and so we missed, you know, the Jews went a bit late, but the Swiss left on time. There was no messing around. So by the time we got to Switzerland, our plane to New York was gone, even though there was a large group of people who needed to connect. Doesn't matter. So they rerouted us to, I think, Paris, and then then we went to New York. But it added a significant amount to the flight, and there was no kosher food. Especially in Europe, they don't mark foods as kosher. You need to have their list. It's really complicated. Anyhow, we suddenly realized, and we flew right after Passover. It was coming back from Passover. And we realized we don't really have so much food. And so suddenly, for the first time, we had to start rationing food. We started, you know, we didn't know exactly when we're going to get where. So we took the snacks that we had and we said, okay, we're not going to eat more now because who knows what's going to be in another 10 hours from now, right? So you ration food when you don't know what's going to happen next. That's the idea of breaking the matzah. The poor man does not know when his next meal is going to come, so he rations off food. So we break the matzah to show that we're sort of acting in an impoverished way to fulfill this description of the matzah of being a bread of affliction and a bread of poverty. That's the story with breaking the matzah. In terms of the afikoman, why you hide the afikoman, some say it's because when the Jews left Egypt, they had to pack the matzahs with them. So they immediately put it in their bags and they put it away and traveled. So that's why we hide the afikomen. Others say the reason for putting the afikomen in a parcel is because, back to the laws of purity and impurity, because in the times of the temple, when you ate the Korban Pesach, you didn't want anyone to touch it, because if someone who wasn't pure touched it, that was it. You didn't have dinner, right? That was the end of that Korban. You cannot eat an impure Korban. And so immediately when they would bring the Korban back home, it would be hidden away. You didn't want anyone to touch it or anything to touch it. And the afikomen is what we eat to remember the Korban Pesach. So in memory of the Korban Pesach, we sort of hide away the afikomen immediately, just like the Jews did when they were eating from the Korban Pesach. Good question. Why the middle matzah? So there's a few explanations. So the three matzahs represent different things. You have some people say Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Some people say Kohen Levi and Yisrael. Some people explain the middle matzah would be who? Who's the middle matzah representing? Going with the Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov model? Yitzchak, right? And so Yitzchak is, it says that Yitzchak had tremendous love for his son despite his shortcomings. Yeah, so Esav was not the greatest son. He wasn't a role model for people, but still he was beloved by his father. And so the idea is to remind us that on this night, the parents should be loving of the child no matter what. And so you take the middle matzah to emphasize this merit of Yitzchak, where he cared for his child no matter what, and we want God to care for us no matter what. And especially when you have this mitzvah of sharing the story, then that's why we do Yitzchak. But there's a whole lot of other explanations. This is just one of them. Okay? Fair? Okay. Now we come to the... Oh, sorry. One more explanation for why we break the middle one. On Shabbat, when you do the motzi, what do you make sure you have? Two matzahs. So I guess the idea is to make sure that you have then... two matzahs that are whole, that the first matzahs that you're going to access, if you would break the top one or the bottom one, you'd be making a bracha on a broken matzah. So the more technical Lithuanian approach to this would be, you break the middle one so that when you're making the blessing later for the meal, you have two complete and whole matzahs. So that's the more technical approach to things. All right, Magid. This is the central part of the Seder. The idea is that there's a mitzvah to say the story of the Seder. So much so that it says that if someone's having a meal just with one other person, they're supposed to ask each other the questions of Manishtana. And it says that if a person is having a Seder on their lonesome, they're all alone, they still need to verbalize the story in a manner of question and answer. So this is a mitzvah that's structured in the form of conversation. So much so is the conversation an integral part of it that if you're by yourself, you gotta have this conversation with yourself, right? Hopefully no one's giving you strange looks when you're doing it. But the idea is you're supposed to have this conversation with yourself. That's the mitzvah of Magid. And it's a mitzvah from the Torah. Many people, by the way, wonder about the following. I'd love to hear your thoughts. There's a mitzvah to mention the exodus from Egypt every single day and night, which is why you have the in the parsha of Tzitzit, it says, Ani Hashem Elokechem asher hotzeiti etchem me'eretz Mitzrayim. So remembering the exodus from Egypt is a mitzvah that takes place year-round. The question that commentaries struggle with, I think there are at least 10 answers to this question, is what's the difference between the mitzvah to say the story of the exodus on the night of Passover to the mitzvah to mention the exodus from Egypt every single day and night throughout the year. Thoughts? Anyone? Explaining to kids, that's one. Yeah, anyone else? On what's the difference between the night of Passover and any night? So some say it's the responsibility to tell others. Others say it's because of the difference is in the mitzvah to elaborate. So on every night, you just need to say it. You just need to say, oh, you know, God took us out of Egypt. On the night of Passover, there's a mitzvah to elaborate. Not only is there a mitzvah to elaborate, but kol hamarbe lesaper b'yitziat Mitzrayim, harei ze meshubach. The more you do it, the better. If you decide tonight to go and expand and really speak a lot about the Exodus from Egypt, not a big mitzvah, right? It's just there's a bare minimum. That's all you got to do. On the night of Passover, the more you discuss it, the more you explain, the greater the mitzvah. So the idea is that the night of Passover, you're supposed to really elaborate. Before Magid begins, there's an Aramaic statement that really has, you can speak about this one for an hour, which is Halach Ma'aniyah. You start off saying, this is the bread of affliction. Kol dichvin yete v'yechol. Anyone who wants to come and eat should come and eat. And this year we're here, next year in Jerusalem. The question then is, why is it that we do this so late in the process? Here. You want a Haggadah?
Yeah, thanks. All right. Okay, good.
So the question is, why invite poor people now? I mean, isn't it kind of late to sit at your Seder table and say, oh, by the way, if anyone would like to come, please come? I mean, it's a nice sentiment, but who is it really helping that you're inviting someone so late in the game? So there are different explanations. One explanation is that we're assuming that everyone has someone else at their table, and you're sort of comforting them. You're saying, don't feel bad that you're here. We all used to be slaves in Egypt, and here, look, here's the bread of affliction that we all ate in Egypt. So, this year we're here. God willing, next year we're in Jerusalem. So it's a way of making the guests comfortable and letting them know, listen, we all used to be slaves in Egypt, and we all ate from this bread of affliction, and this year we're here in exile, and God willing, by next year, the Mashiach is going to come, and we'll all be celebrating in Jerusalem. So it's a way of, the assumption of the Haggadah is that you already invited people. So that's Halach Ma'aniyah, and that also explains what the connection is between the making the poor people comfortable and the Lashana Abba B'Yerushalayim, which kind of don't seem to go together. And the idea is you're kind of comforting the people that are coming. All right, Manishtana. First of all, first things first, what is the answer to Manishtana? Anyone? Four questions. You always ask them, what's the answer? Anyone? No? Sorry? Excellent. So you have four questions with one answer. You ask Manishtana, why is this not? A lot of times I'll ask students or whoever it is, and I'll say, you know, here's the Manishtana, where's the answer? And people are like, I don't know, where is the answer? Because, we make such a big deal of the Manishtana, we forget that there's an answer coming. So the idea is, we ask the Manishtana, but ultimately the answer is, Avadim hayinu leparo b'mitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and if Hashem wouldn't take us, we would still be slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. There's a very interesting explanation I saw to Manishtana, a more sophisticated twist on things. What are the four questions of Manishtana? Help me here, because the first one is, why is it that on all nights we eat... Oh, you have it right there. Where is it? What page?
Six.
All right. So, what's the first question? Chametz u'matzah. Why is it that every night you can eat either leavened bread or unleavened bread, and tonight only matzah? And then the next question?
Bitter herbs.
So why are we eating, every night we eat normal vegetables, tonight we're eating these bitter herbs? It seems strange. Then the next question?
Dipping.
Every night you may dip something, but tonight you dip twice. You dip the karpas and the maror and the charoset. Why that? And last but not least, leaning. Why is it that tonight you lean? So a very interesting explanation of this is that the child is confused, because On the one hand, we're doing things that represent slavery on this night. What are we doing? Exactly, right? The matzah represents a bread of affliction. So you're showing that, you know, we're poor. Then you have the maror, also shows a bitter experience. And then you flip and you say, oh, tonight we're gonna dip, which is a royal way of behaving, and also we're going to recline. So the child is confused. Why is it that we're doing tonight? And by the way, there's a lot of these things throughout the Seder, not just that we do. Some things we do in a fashion of like affliction, and other things we do in a way of showing that we're royal and all, you know, all fancy. There's these conflicting messages. And so the answer is, Avadim Hayinu L'Paro B'Mitzrayim. There was one night where we started off that night, the same night, we started off as slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and we ended the night as free people. So it's interesting. What we're saying in the Manishtana, in a way, is that the night began as an experience of slavery, and it ended off as an experience of freedom. So that's, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Where does that suggest dreams? No,
so the third one, it says, I'll read the English here. On all the other nights, we do not dip even once. Tonight, why do we dip the greens twice?
Yeah, that's what they're translating it. Where's the word
green? Oh, you're right. That correct.
But it's a double dipping, which is colloquially used in English to suggest that you're taking more than you really want to take when you go on your own.
Yeah.
It's like we're having double portions of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You
know what? I haven't noticed this before. Is it like this in other Haggadahs?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where they got it from.
As a child, I was very confused because I thought I was supposed to take the whatever vegetable and do it twice.
Oh, yeah, no double dipping, right? That's a big one, yeah. Right. Right. No, I believe that the two dips it's referring to is the karpas and the maror and the charoset, but I don't know why they added the greens. It's I don't know. It's what's the word for it? When the translator takes the liberty to edit. There's a term for it when literary activism. I don't know what it's basically. The translator is sort of a bit overstepped. But yeah, not necessarily greens. Doesn't have to. Sorry? Yeah, license, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point. So that's in the Manishtana, there's sort of these two different themes, and the answer is Avadim Hayinu L'Paro B'Mitzrayim. Now we have the, at this point, by the way, you're supposed to put the ke'ara back, and you're supposed to, again, show the matzahs, and you say, Avadim Hayinu L'Paro B'Mitzrayim, and we say that even if we were very wise, and even if we were all very knowledgeable, there's a mitzvah to tell the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim tonight. And the rationale for this is to say that telling the story of the Exodus tonight is not about knowledge, it's not about giving knowledge, it's about experience. And by the way, that's the answer to the Sheino, Tam and Sheino Yodei Lishol. It's really not just about information, it's about an experience. So what we're saying is that even if we're very smart, it doesn't matter. Even if you have all the knowledge, the idea is to relive the experience, because if you don't relive it and connect it, it doesn't have the same value. So that's Vafilu Kulanu Chachamim, Kulanu Nevonim, and that's why it's followed by the famous story of the rabbis sitting in Bnei Brak, and their students come. That's on page 8. I'll just read it. I'll read it in English, and there's actually a fascinating historical backdrop to this story. It happened that Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yehoshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon were reclining at a seder in Bnei Brak. They were discussing the exodus from Egypt all that night until their students came and told them, "Our masters, the time has come for reciting the morning Shema." Now, before getting to any details, a technical point is, why couldn't they see the light on their own? Why are their students coming and saying, the time has come to say the Shema? They're so engrossed in their studying. Okay, so what? But why are the students not engrossed with them? They're like wanting to... Okay, so please. Exactly. This is the time. I mean, these are the rabbis. Eventually, some of them are martyred. These are the rabbis who are living at a time where it's illegal to study Torah. And so if you go to Israel, they have all these caves where they would sit. So you would have a watchman outside, and you would do the mitzvah inside. And eventually, if something's happening, they can warn you. So their students came and told them, "Rabbis, the time has come for saying the Shema of the morning," because they're living at a time where being outside or having big windows is not an option if you're going to study Torah. But what the story is mainly coming to say is that even it's illustrating that even if you are very smart and bright, the main experience of the Seder is to experience it, not just to get knowledge, but to feel as you're part of it. And this is why these rabbis who had a huge amount of knowledge and had a whole year to study, still, they always had more to discuss the night of the Seder because they were experiencing it. And that's what you're supposed to do on this night. You're supposed to experience it. Now, the next paragraph on page 9 often gets lost in the story about the rabbi's beard. I'm sure you've all heard it. Did everyone hear it? Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? All right. So people, I don't mean to further distract, but basically the part of this in schools that gets the most attention is it says, Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Hare ani keven 70 shana. Rabbi Elazar says, I am like 70 years old. And then he goes on to say what he has to say, but people often discuss the fact that he says, Ani keven 70 shana. I am like 70 years old. And they refer to a famous story in the Talmud in Brachot where there was sort of a rebellion and an overturning of power from Rabban Gamliel, who was the Nasi, and then it also had to do with politics between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And eventually they appoint this third party guy, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and he's very young. So it says that some of rabbis had no respect for him because he was so young, and some people say that his beard became white overnight, and that was a way of him being assisted by God to be respected and look a bit older than his own age. But that's not the main point here. The main point is that he's saying that all my years I did not see someone bring a source, quote a source, that you should mention Yetziat Mitzrayim at night until Ben Zoma came and said that showed in the Pasuk there's a mitzvah to remember Yetziat Mitzrayim in day and at night. And Chachamim still did not accept his position and believe that there is a mitzvah to mention Yetziat Mitzrayim every day, but not at night. And the other part of the Pasuk is used to teach that we need to remember Yetziat Mitzrayim even when Mashiach comes, to show what an important mitzvah we have. All right, now we're coming to the four children. So we start beforehand, Baruch HaMakom. Does everyone sing it or say it? You know, right, there's Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu. Now, why do you say Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu? It's an interesting, again, a Lithuanian spin. One of the mitzvahs in the Torah is Birkot HaTorah. Before you study Torah, there's a bracha you're supposed to say. And so some people say that in case someone didn't say Birkot HaTorah, we say Baruch Shenatan Torah L'Amo Yisrael. You know when you get an aliyah, you say Birkot HaTorah before the person reads the Torah? So the idea is, before you're going to study Torah hardcore, you say a Birkot HaTorah. So some say that that's what it's about. Others, taking a more poetic approach to this, say that what we're saying is, thank God, Baruch HaMakom, who has given us a Torah with multiple approaches. It's not one approach for every single person asking a question. There's four approaches. There's for the Chacham, Rasha, Tam, and She'eno Yodea Lishol. So some say that is the Baruch HaMakom. Thank God who has given us a Torah that speaks to multiple people. That is that's the Baruch HaMakom. And now we come to the Chacham. Does anyone want to help us with the Chacham's question and answer? Anyone? Where is it? Page 9. It's always funny to look in the Haggadahs and see the pictures they have for every single child. There's this Haggadah that was distributed in the kibbutzim in the early 1900s, where, you know, some of the people that came were hardcore socialists, and you know, they wanted to leave everything behind. So you have, you know, they believed in the value of work, and they had the picture of the Chacham, and it was this guy, you know, muscles and working in the field. And then they had a picture of the Rasha, and it's this guy sitting with a Gemara studying. it's always funny to see how every Haggadah reflects their Chacham and their Rasha. It's funny. So what's the question of the Chacham?
Mm-hmm. Seems to be bring about the possibility of a very, very, very detailed answer. But the answer that's given is almost flippant. It's very brief.
Mm-hmm.
It's highly along the lines of teaching me totally while I'm standing on one foot.
Mm-hmm. It's a short answer. Okay. Anyone? Yeah, anyone else on the answer to the Chacham? What's the answer? It's hard to even translate. I'm curious what they translate here. You in turn shall instruct him in the laws of Pesach. Oh, so they do say this answer. There's no dessert after eating the Korban Pesach. Some people say... Oh, really? So actually, what's funny is, what's apparent from this part of the Haggadah is that the word afikoman is mistranslated and misused today. Very misused. Because the word afikoman is a word actually in Latin, and it means dessert. So what it was saying is, ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman. You cannot eat after the Korban Pesach dessert. Once you've eaten the Korban Pesach, which was saved to the end of the meal, where we eat the current afikomen, that is where people ate the Korban Pesach in the time of the temple. And the idea is, we're telling the Chacham Mahalacha that belongs to the very end of the Seder, which is you cannot eat anything after the Korban Pesach. Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach. You cannot, maftirin is, again, just like maftir, it's the end. Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman. Do not eat dessert after the Korban Pesach. So we took it, and instead of calling the afikoman something else, which is similar to the Korban Pesach, which would probably cause problems because you give it the name of a korban, but we call the matzah an afikoman when really the afikoman is the step after. It's the forbidden step. Afikoman means dessert. So we're saying here, do not eat dessert after eating the Korban Pesach. And we took the name dessert and applied it to the matzah that we eat in memory of the Korban Pesach. But either way, the answer to the Chacham is, some say, that we tell them all the laws from the beginning up to the very last law. Basically, if someone's smart and wants to learn, give them all the information. That's what we're saying here. You got a Chacham? Just say everything. That's the answer to the Chacham. I always ask people, what's the difference between the question of the Chacham and the Rasha? Very similar question. They're both wanting to know. There's only one difference. They're both saying, what's going on? What are we doing? I want to learn more, sort of. Both intelligent, and that's why they're juxtaposed. Why is it that the... Why is it that the Rasha is treated so differently? The answer is, the Rasha excludes himself. He says, listen, ma ha'avodah zot lachem, why are you guys doing this? And he sort of says, you know, this is not something that belongs to me. And then the answer to that is that if you would have been in Egypt, Hashem would not take you out. So that's what we're saying here. There's actually a very interesting, again, mistranslation. The word hakeh in Hebrew, what does the word hakeh mean? There's 10 makos. What does the word makah mean? How do you spell that? How do you spell makah? Anyone? How do you spell makah? Like the 10 makos. Mem. What's in the middle? It's not a trick question. Kaf and a hey, right? What's the word here for blunting his teeth? It's a kuf. It's not the same word, but it's a very widely accepted translation. It's a mistake. It's not, people take it as afhata hakeh chinav, like knock his teeth out, right? It's not, because it's not hakeh chinav, it's a homonym. Hakeh chinav just is a term in the mostly in Nach, in Mishle. It's just a term for like giving someone a good answer in a way that sort of you won the argument. Afata hakeh echinav. It doesn't mean you should. People are then like, oh, well, what does this mean? Why are we knocking the poor fellow's teeth out? What did he do to deserve it? He only asked the question. It's a mis. The whole conversation is based on a mistranslation. It's afata hakeh echinav. It means basically give him a good answer, which is, if you would have been there, you wouldn't have been redeemed, because people who didn't want to leave Egypt did not leave. So that's that. And then come the Tamen Sheino Yodal Yishol, and the Haggadah says about that later on it follows up by saying the mitzvah of Magid is only when you have matzah and maror in front of you. The idea is, for a Tamen Sheino Yodal Yishol, the best learning, there's something called today in the world of education, experiential learning. Anyone ever hear about that? Experiential learning? The idea is the Seder is experiential learning. And so we're saying for the Tam and the Rasha, we try to teach them, but then the next paragraph immediately starts, Yachol merosh chodesh, tamu lomar bayomahu, lo amarti ela b'shash matza umaro munachim lefanecha. Teach the Tam and the Sheino Yodel Ishol in an experiential way. When there's matzah and maror, it's really the most experiential learning. The whole Seder, we're learning through eating. And so that's what we're trying to give the Tam and the Rasha. I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention the famous Lubavitcher Rebbe thing. Everyone picks it up for a different purpose with the fifth child, where the Lubavitcher Rebbe said famously that there is also a fifth child that's not mentioned in the Haggadah, and that's the child that doesn't make it to the Seder. You know, the importance of reaching out to people who are not going to be at the Seder. All right, there's a theme that stands very strongly in the Seder, which is Matchil Begnut Umesayim Beshvach. The rabbis in Talmud say this is a prerequisite for telling the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. You always start off with the gnut literally means negativity, and you finish with the positivity. Meaning, you can't appreciate democracy unless you know what tyranny is. You can't appreciate health unless you know what the absence of it is. You can't appreciate light unless you know what darkness is. So the story of the Haggadah must be said in a way of contrasting it with what happened before. Some say spiritually, some say physically. Meaning, some start off with speaking about Terach. Our forefathers were idol worshippers. That's where we come from. That's spiritual, right? You start off and say, spiritually speaking, we used to be in the dumps. We used to be Terach. We used to be idol worshippers, and now God brought us close to his worship. That's one position, and we follow both positions, by the way. The other position is Avadim Hayinu LeParo BeMitzrayim. We start off saying, we used to be slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. And so, again, we start off with the negativity and only then move on to the positivity. So both positions are followed, both are written in the Haggadah, but both are taking the same idea, which is start off negative, end off positive. either Avadim Ayinu, to God took us out of slavery, or Terach was our forefather to saying that God brought us out to Mount Sinai. All right, now is actually something that's very relevant to current affairs. It says, Vayareu otanu hamitzrim bayanunu. The Egyptians were mean to us. That's a bit later. Where is it? Page 15. It literally translates, if you look at the... they have the translation here. You see on page 16, the Egyptians treated us badly. Right? Vayareu otanu hamitzrim bayanunu. The Egyptians treated us badly. However, if that would be the case, it would say vayareu lanu hamitzrim. Proper Hebrew would be, they did bad to us. But it doesn't say vayareu lanu, it says vayareu otanu. There's a very interesting commentary from the Sforno, medieval commentator, who says it means not that they treated us badly, but they made us into the bad guys. And that's so relevant, because when the Jewish people suffer anti-Semitism, sometimes it comes just by being treated badly. That's what happened often in Jews who lived in Arab countries, right? They were just, you know, one day someone came over to you and, you know, turned your store over and burnt your house. That's being treated badly. Then there were other forms of being treated badly, which is they didn't just come over and start destroying or harming us or our property. What they did is they spun us in a bad way. The Jews are controlling the economy. The Jews are capitalists. The Jews are socialists. The Jews are too rich. The Jews are too poor. The Jews are plotting against us. That's what happens with Pharaoh. And that's what the Pasuk says. Let us deal with them wisely, lest they multiply. And if there should be a war against us, they will join our enemies. They had to first vilify the Jews. Even the Egyptians, they couldn't just start attacking the Jews. They started off by vilifying the Jews, by saying, oh, these people, they're really against us. And that's unfortunately, it comes from a good place in human character, which is you don't just do something bad to someone. But it speaks to a horrible experience, which is you start off saying bad things. You know, you see it a bit today, rising up.
There's a psychiatric term, it's called projection. The tendency of a person to take their own impulse and project it on someone else.
Exactly, yes. It's like what they said when the... in 1948... a lot of people in the Arab world were saying, well, if the Jews will have a state of their own and Arabs are going to be a minority, they're going to massacre them and kill them all. Because anyone who was, that's what they would have done had we lost the war, right? So it was like, oh, this is what the Jews are about to do, because we would have done this if they would have lost. So, yeah. So that's what happened with Pharaoh. Vayareu otanu hamitzrim. They didn't just do bad to us. They first said, oh, these guys are out to get us first, which wasn't true. So that's what the Egyptians did to us. Now, a very interesting thing, and I'd love to hear your answers. It says on page 18, and we cried out to the Lord, the God of our fathers, as it is written, during that long period, the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel groaned because of their servitude, and they cried out. This passage in the Haggadah is doing something very interesting. It's taking verses from Chumash Dvarim, Parashat Bikurim, and explaining them with verses from Shemot. So there's the pasuk that's making a statement, and then there's proof to it from Shemot. Where's the proof? Anyone see the proof? Again, the statement is in bold, and we cried out to the Lord, the God of our fathers, added as it is written. What's the proof from as it is written? What's it called? Supporting claim, supporting argument. Sorry? You make a statement and then you try and bring a supporting argument. So where's the support? Says that we cried out to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and then it says that the Jews groaned. So there's a more of a poetic, homiletical explanation, which says that whenever the Jew, whenever any Jew is groaning, they're really crying out to God. Whenever you ever hear someone krecht in old Yiddish, it's like oy rebbeinu shel olam, right? When there's always, whenever you're groaning and crying out and complaining, it's always ultimately crying out to Hashem, which is why, you know, there's a book about it, something about there's a terrible book. I shouldn't say this, but there's this book called Born to Kvetch about Jews. So the idea is whenever a Jew kvetches, it's because he or she believe that someone's listening. So that's the idea here is that when the Jews kvetched in Egypt, they were crying out to Hashem. We're going to stop here, but thank you everyone. If you have any questions, comments, sorry? Thank you. Thanks a lot. Right. Yeah. It's a good point. Yeah, maybe because it's at Ptachlo. The mother's supposed to approach because she'll probably do a better job. Some people raise a similar point about, this is a whole new discussion, but Vehisha Amda. Why is it Vehisha Amda? Are you speaking about God, or is it speaking about the promise that Hashem made to? But some people say, oh, it's in the merit of the Jewish women that the Jewish people were able to endure the, you know, whatever that we've been through throughout the generations. But it's a good point. All right. Sorry? The egg on the Seder plate? Good question. The shank bone is for the Passover sacrifice, right? At the time of the Beit HaMikdash, you brought a korban every time you celebrated one of the three festivals in Jerusalem, korban chagigah. The egg represents the korban chagigah, so it's to show that there were two sacrifices eaten on that night if you were in Jerusalem. You know what? That just came to my attention. I think Sephardic people do it. Now, does everyone here have an egg to eat? Some people, yes, I don't do that. What? Yeah, some people do it. I don't. Yeah, well, eggs in general, it's a person that's mourning is eating something round. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. Maybe. It